Blog Talk Radio.
Hosted by author Stephen James and Susan May Warren. This is where you hear great storytellers talk about great stories. And tonight we have a very special guest in Davis Bunn, internationally acclaimed novelist and writer in residence at Oxford University. You're in for a very, very special treat tonight when you hear what he's got going on. It's going to be an exciting show. We also want to let you know to make sure that you check out a couple places. Check out Dark Renaissance Books, see what they got going on. They got a lot of great titles out there. Of course, KensingtonBooks.com is also a great place. And Cut and Cover by Kevin Hurley is now available. Make sure you go to Amazon and check out that book. But let's not waste any time and let's get right into it. Without any further ado, here we go, The Story Blender with very special guest Davis Bunn. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Susan May Warren.
And I'm Stephen James.
And this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. So it's going to be a great event today, Stephen. I'm so excited about our awesome guest that we have on board.
Yeah, I know. I met him probably almost 15 years ago at a writer's conference, and we've become friends over the years, and I feel like both a friend and also a student of him. He's got great insights into the art of storytelling.
Oh, I know. I sat under his teaching not long ago and was completely blown away by what he had to say. So let me tell you a little bit about him. He's an internationally acclaimed author who sold more than 7 million books in 16 languages, and his name is Davis Bunn. And he's equal parts writer, scholar, teacher, and sportsman. Now, he was born and raised in North Carolina, but he left for Europe at age 20. And there he first completed graduate studies in economics and finance, and then he became a businessman, and then that career took him to over 40 countries in Europe, Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. Now, Davis wrote for 9 years and completed 7 books before his first was accepted for publication. And during that time, he continued to work full-time in his business career, traveling to 2 and sometimes 3 countries every week. So he had a full plate, and he was still writing. Now, his first published book, The Presence, was released in 1990 and became a national bestseller. He's continued to inspire and attract fans worldwide for the last 25 years. These days, he splits his time between the United States and England, where he serves as writer-in-residence at Regent's Park College, Oxford University. Cool, huh? Davis, we're so excited that you're here. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm actually calling from England for this.
Wow.
And that's
time
over
cool.
Your dedication.
No. This is a lot of fun.
So, Davis, I don't even know if you remember, but, okay, so in 2001, I attended a writing conference you were teaching in North Carolina. Okay, and that's when I was starting to play with ideas for my first novel, and I actually ended up pursuing this for a living, so you're at least partially to blame for me being a novelist and turning out the way that I have.
You know, it's amazing. When you said that you'd had this contact 15 years ago, I was thinking, panic, you know, because I didn't remember this, so... That's really cool, and it's been really interesting because obviously I love your work, and I have sort of been in awe of some of the things that you've done with your mysteries, and so I didn't realize that I had this you know element of blame in there also.
Yes,
but
yes.
It's
blame
really
is a good
cool.
way to say it.
Yeah.
Well, very
well
cool.
I think that's awesome. It's good to know who to blame for Stephen.
Really?
You know, that's, yeah, absolutely. Now I know where to point my finger. That's really, really great. So can I ask, you teach all over, and I've been at conferences where you've been teaching and been able to sneak into your classes, and they're fantastic. But
thank
every
you.
Fiction instructor has a different approach to teaching. And they start, you know, of course, with what lies at the heart of a great story. So when you're talking, now you have a ton of information. I mean, you are like you know, like the scholar. But, you know, aspiring writers don't know that much. So where do you start with aspiring writers, helping them understand what lies at the heart of a story?
The first class, well, I have to back up. What I try to do in terms of keeping the instruction fresh is that every time I go to a major conference, I try to have one segment that I've never taught before. But one element that has remained the same now for almost 10 years is the first hour, and that starts with the issue of why is the writer there? In other words, what is the emotional motive that gets them in the door? Because I feel like quite often for aspiring writers, there's this hunger or burning urge or whatever you want to call it, but there's not something that's been formulated in any concrete degree. And for them to get through whatever it is that they have as their trial by fire, and I mean, you know, it's like, okay, you say it's amazing that I wrote for 9 years and finished 7 books before my first was accepted and I was working full-time during this. But to be perfectly honest, I've never met a successful author who hasn't had some impossibility like this to overcome. And I think really part of what's required in order to get through this is going back to the fundamental purpose of what it is that you're here for. What is the emotion that most drives you forward? Because sooner or later, there's going to be that need to come to terms with the kernel, the essential element that's at the core of the creative urge in terms of building what is the author's voice. The voice, when we're, I mean, there's a number of different terms that, you know, you never use on the book, but are still very important in terms of talking about the craft. And one of these is the concept of an author's voice. And what we're talking about here is arriving at the point that when a reader picks up your book from now and then picks up your book from 20 years from now, they know within the first few sentences that it's you. And it's not just about the way that you structure the sentences or the way that you create a story concept. It goes down to the fundamental elements that are there in the way you craft, particularly point of view. So what you're doing here at this stage is you're creating a tonal structure that's based upon the core element of whatever it is that drove you to write in the first place. So starting with this question, why are you here, gives you this foundation for everything else that's happening inside the class. And I've had some amazing answers. The most amazing answer I've ever had actually was not from one of my students, but was from a student of Annie Lennox who starts a class very similar to the way that I do. And she had a student who came up afterwards and said that at the beginning of her teen years, she was sexually abused, and then she was forced by her parents to be silent about it. And she said, I will never be silenced again. Now, from this, there comes this very clear sense of a core element. I mean, it's a driving force that everyone I've talked to who's heard this has been just instantly galvanized. But then there's the question of what do you do with this? Is it about revenge? Is it the destruction of society? Is it healing? You see, it's still a choice, but the emotion, that core thing that will not change, is there at the forefront and understood by the author.
That's awesome. That makes me think a lot about the core of, you know, you can apply that wherever you are in the journey. Like whatever, you know, if you've written 50 books like I have, I'm still going to start out by saying, what's driving this story? What's the emotion? Why would I want to write this story? And I that's fantastic. So now you've written a lot of different genres. from, you know, fantasy to techno thrillers to historicals, which those are the ones that I've read a lot of, and even heartwarming holiday stories. And so what draws you to a specific genre and then story within that genre? So what, you know, how, you know, do you have one that you particularly love? Which ones do you find the most challenging? So tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. It's a really good question, and I'm going to give you an honest answer, which I don't often do because it's sort of like you watch these movie stars when they do the film roundups, and mm-hmm. they've been asked the same question 150 times, and it's just this canned response. Okay, this is not a canned question, and neither is the answer. So when I started, my first break came from what's called the CBA marketplace, which at the time mm-hmm. it wasn't that clear, but it's basically it's called the Christian Booksellers Association, and at its heyday, the time when it had reached its zenith was 2008, 2009, when it was around 11% of the total fiction market in the United States. Hmm. And since then, it's dropped down to about 9%, but it's still, you know, it's fairly sizable. But back in the 90s, this was teeny tiny. And so I had a book that was accepted, and at the time, I mean, just to give you an idea of comparison, the first book that I had published was called The Presence. It was a political mm-hmm. thriller, came out in 1991. It was a finalist for the CBA's big prize. It's called the Gold Medallion. And it was picked up by a couple of the book clubs, the big book clubs at the time. The biggest of these was Word, and then it was a condensed version with Reader's Digest. And it still sold under 100,000 copies, and it was one of the top 10 sellers of the year. So, I mean, you know, the market at this point was really small. And I had I had a sequel that I did directly after this. And then after that, my grandmother, who was very important to me in terms of my personal development and stability of a very unstable early years, was having very severe health problems. And so I decided that I would write this short, basically it was a homily, but it was called A Quilt, and it was a story based on her later life. And when I sent it in to the publishers, they said, A, it was really good. B, they didn't know what to do with it, and so they were going to sit on it until I had a bigger hit, and then they were going to try to sell it to some magazine. It was only normal base for a novel the smallest novel that's accepted for publication is around 65,000 words, and this was 42,000 words long. And so they basically sat on it for 2 years, and then I sent it to a lady, an editor at Thomas Nelson, who was interested in trying to find something that Bethany, you know, didn't have on a contract, and she read this and she loved it. And then Bethany said, no, we'll publish it. And they published, they decided they were going to do a gift book, which had never been done in the CBA with fiction before. They did a 3,000 print run, and it sold 350,000 copies.
Oh, nice.
So,
wow.
Yeah, so,
that's
so
great.
All of a sudden, I had this other, because, you know, as anyone who's been published will tell you, as soon as you have a hit, they're saying, give us another. So I had the political thrillers on one hand, and I had this thing that I'd done for my grandmother that was launching this second career.
Right,
and
right.
So, yeah, so I had a good time with both of them, and at the time, there wasn't such a thing as, which basically is defining authors these days, which was author branding. And that's why I mentioned at the beginning of this that the market was so small, because it was so small, Bethany basically, they just said, you know, whatever that I sent them that was within the bounds of what was considered CBA fiction, they would publish. And so I wound up doing a book a year that was a political drama and another book a year that was women's fiction.
Right.
And then Thomas Nelson came in and said, okay, you know, we missed out on the quilt. we forgive you, but we're starting this new line, and we want to try to break into the mainstream from the Christian direction. And we're taking Frank Peretti, who just had This Present Darkness, and two other authors, and we want to give you one. Do you have something big that you can do? And I said, well, I've always wanted to do a historical drama, an adventure story, sort of like a Dr. Zhivago romance, mm-hmm. adventure romance, based around the life of Constantine, the mm-hmm. emperor of the Roman mm-hmm. Empire that brought Christianity out of the catacombs. And they said, okay. So all of a sudden it was like, you know, if I had the time. So
mm-hmm.
so that was where I started off in historical fiction. So, by the time they started doing the branding issue, I was already so mixed up that it just, you know, there was no way they was going to be able to sort of, you know, catalog me.
Right.
And this has been a problem, because nowadays, and really this has been true since the late 90s, the CBA and the ABA in this sense are very much the same. And that is that when you declare yourself with whatever the manuscript is that you send in as the initial published work, the contract, because they are so concerned, the publishers are so concerned with the expense and the effort that's required to establish a new author, they will actually state in the contract, if there is a sequel that's contracted for this, a second book,
mm-hmm.
that they will name the characters so that there is no question but that you must maintain the same direction and story thrust that you started with the first. Branding has become almost a catchword for the construct of a new successfully published commercial author.
Yeah. I agree. And it's interesting. Now, I started way back when, too, before branding was important, and I wrote all over the place. But I think that I have a question about that, and that is, you know, I started reading your books way back when you had, I think it was called The Priceless Collection. It was set in Russia. There was, I think, a Florian's Gate and the Amber Room, and so those were, a while back. But then I found that you had written some books with Jeanette Oak. And so then I read those, and they were great. And then I went over and I said, oh, wait a second, he's got these cool sort of biblical kind of books that you wrote, kind of. And then it was like The Warning or something like that. And so anyway, I was kind of reading all over because I liked you and I liked your writing. And so, do you feel like you went out and got new audience through these different genres and that have followed you, or have you not seen that as much? Am I an anomaly?
Back in the 80s, this was fairly normal. I mean, the example that I like to use the most was Herman Wouk. Another is William Goldman, both of whom were successful as authors who wrote all over the page. Herman Wouk, for example, did two of the most successful World War II novels of the 20th century, War and Remembrance, and I can't remember the other title. And William Goldman was doing both historicals. He did fantasy. He did two Oscar-winning screenplays. And again, there was that sense of, because they are at this level of quality, the audience was willing to go with them wherever they wanted. And in the early days, this was accepted. But then around 2003, 2004, I had a series of issues that really created some difficulties for me in my career, and I can either leave it at that or I can describe them for you. I mean, what do you think your reader, your listeners want to hear?
Well, what do you
we
think?
We want to know about the
we
struggle.
We do want to know, but we want to know what the takeaway is. How do
elaborate
we not...
on the pain.
Okay. What do you want to hear? Okay. Jeanette had started having health problems, and she really liked my writing, and she came to me and said, you know, why don't we do some books together, because she felt that finding someone that she could trust in terms of emotion and story would grant her an opportunity both to extend her career and also at the end of her career have an opportunity to do a greater sense of drama, which she was not doing in the books that she was writing by herself. So for the first 3 years, she wrote a book herself, and then she did a book with me, and then she stopped writing the books that she had by herself, and she just did this books with me, and we ended up doing 12 books together.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I was invited by Doubleday to do a series of books with them that were intended for the mainstream, and what they wanted was for me to take the Christian element out as an overt issue and look at it strictly from the standpoint of the moral structure. And the first book I did with them, The Great Divide, was a national bestseller, and then I did two more. And both of these did quite well. And then it was just 2004, 2005, 2006, there was this sort of cascade of issues that came up. The editor that I was working with at Doubleday got cancer. I was passed over to an editor that I really, to say that we did not get along does not even begin to describe the issues that we had. I'll just give you one example. He was having this ongoing argument with me over the direction of my third book, and this was after the first two had been national bestsellers. And the example that he gave me of what he wanted was the Da Vinci Code, which Doubleday at that point had just bought. And I got the raw manuscript, the unedited manuscript. Mm-hmm. And if you think the Da Vinci Code is badly written, you should have seen it in its raw form.
Oh, no.
It was unbelievable.
Wow.
So I've got this, and this is the... this is the model that they want me to use for my next book. And
wow.
Then the third book came out. It was a success, and the editor and I just decided, you know, it just wasn't worth it. It wasn't worth it. So
wow.
Thomas Nelson had decided they were going to try again to set up a mainstream arm, and this time it was me and Ted Decker and... I can't remember the others. But anyway, once again, it didn't work. But by this point, I was just desperate to find a way out. And it was 3 years before we realized that selling from the CBA into the ABA was extremely difficult, both
mm-hmm.
from the standpoint of the independent bookstores who didn't like to buy from a CBA publisher and from the standpoint of the critics, who were necessary to get a book out into the, you know, Barnes & Nobles and the B. Daltons at the time.
Yeah.
And then the other issue I had was not only had Jeanette retired, but I was faced with this crisis of the market. I mean, in 2006, 2007, the publishing world started going through all of the preliminary issues that we talk about today as sort of like standards. And so there was this panic among established authors that they were looking for someone that was going to offer them a long-term contract that would give them the same level of advances that they'd been getting up to this point. And my wife has been my agent since my first book was published, we were watching this and we were thinking that this is just, it's insane, because over that period, one of the first telltales, I mean, if you look at it from the standpoint of the music industry as the model, it was every year the publishing world was saying things like, well, okay, we've survived the downturn. And it's like, no, I'm sorry, you guys, you know, it's just, it's insane. It's just started. So the it's sort of like looking at the highest paid people on a professional sports team. If these guys don't perform to the level that's required, it's not that they are getting less money the next year. They don't have a contract.
Right.
And
right.
There's nothing that I want to do more than write. So the idea of building up this big, you know, unearnable, unreturnable advance because of my name at this point was ridiculous. So we decided, and it came around just about the same time that the downturn started really gathering force, we decided what we would rather do was to go in and accept whatever advance was realistically earnable, but go for a higher level of return and not be tied to a restricted contract. And this is the norm now. Normally, when you sign with a publisher nowadays, they want you to be an exclusive.
Right.
And so usually what you can do in negotiating a contract, and this is for all of the new authors out there, you can ask for one thing. You can have one change that you can sort of bend on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way you need to go into the negotiation. What is the one point that you don't want to give up on? And for us, it was, we don't want an exclusive contract. We decided that was the one thing that we would not give up.
Mm-hmm.
So the result has been that I was able to maintain what has been the constant for me, and that is about four full-length projects each year.
Wow.
And then the other thing that I started, there were two things that started at this point. We were aware by 2006 that this was not it was not going to be something where, you know, we live through this year and then everything's going to be better. It's like, okay,
right,
this is the new reality.
Right.
And so the question is, how do we grow beyond this? How do we take advantage of this? There's a very famous banker from the World War I era who, and this is completely off the subject, but I just found this really important to me at the time. It was one of the Rothsteins. The Rothschilds. The Rothschilds had it was the last gathering before World War I actually closed the borders between the European nations. And people at this point were clearly terrified that something was going to happen that pushed the world over the brink. And the senior Rothschild gathered everyone together in Paris, and, you know, the last time they were ever going to get together, clearly most of the people were expecting some sort of, you know, you are my brothers, my friends, we're going to live through this and come out the other side. And instead, this guy stands up, and the only thing he tells them is, the best time to make money is when there's blood on the streets. I just thought that was
wow.
So cool.
Yeah. That's good.
And I feel like that's one of the problems with most of the people that are talking about the market today is they're focusing on the negative. It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's a trauma. It's all of this. And the only people who are not are that teeny tiny percent at the top who are, you know, in a strong enough audience position that they can effectively still maintain that position of dictating terms to the industry. The question is, how do you get there?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we have been focusing on for the past 6 years. How do you get there? How do you arrive at a point where you not only survive this period of uncertainty within the publishing world, but thrive?
Right. That is a fantastic question. So do you have some tips for us?
Yeah, I do. I think the first thing that needs to be understood is that the normal rule book, the things that are usually talked about in classes, no longer dominate the market. And this is true in a number of different directions. And one of these is that this concept of the author as a sort of a, you know, we're all creative people are very self-centered. Let's be completely honest. You know, we think the world revolves around us. We may not talk about it, but that's actually what we think. But one of the problems with this is that the fundamental elements that define who we see ourselves as artists include a lot of things that are very self-indulgent. For example, for me, one of the things is productivity. Now, I'm contracted to do 3 books a year. This covers our expenses. If we look at it from the standpoint of, and that's, I mean, this is our only source of income, so we have to be very realistic about this. If we look at it from the standpoint of the sales level of today, we're in good shape. But, and this is 2 big buts. One is, how can I raise the level of sales above the expectations of the publishing house? That's the first thing. And that is the question that has to be asked with every publication. The second is, how do I grow beyond this in terms of the way the publishing house views me in advance of receiving the next book? That's the big thing. How do I change the way they expect? What are they, if they're looking at me right now as being a sort of, you know, just below the New York Times level, for example, how do I get them to see me as the next potential top 10 bestseller? And so there are 2 different answers to this. What I did for the answer of the first, which was how do I raise myself here, is the first thing I had to accept was, and there's several things, but and I'll just give you one now, but the first thing that I needed to accept in terms of raising the bar on the book that I'm doing right now is that I needed to look at my own creative standpoint from the perspective of the weaknesses that I have as an artist. And I think for a lot of people that arrive at a certain level of success, there's a tendency to focus primarily on the strengths. And this is where I think for many writers, you know, getting on in years, there's that sense of repetitiveness. It comes from, it's not a sense of I want to do the same thing over again. I don't think there's any artist out there who would actually feel that way about their craft. But it's because they know their strengths and they focus on them. To my mind, if I'm going to grow beyond where I am as a you know, commercial artist, I need to look at it honestly from the standpoint of where am I weakest. So when I start planning a new project, the first thing I look at is where do I need to grow? Then in terms of the how do I change myself and the attitude of the publisher towards the book that I'm about ready to give them so that they look at it from the standpoint of why should they invest more in me than everyone is expecting to get back. The answer I have found is that I need to look beyond the boundaries of branding. I think one of the things that's changed over the last 4 or 5 years is the branding concept no longer works. People still talk about it because it's almost like the crutch. You've got to have the branding issue in order to get published, and you've got to have the branding issue in order to sell it into the bookstore. But as far as the buyer is concerned, as far as the audience is concerned, branding isn't enough. There's too much out there. And I'm not talking about books now. I'm just talking about this constant flow of everything from tweets to electronic gaming to the self-published books. How do you get enough notice in a crowded, electronically dominated marketing realm so that you can grow up beyond the expectations of the publisher? And my answer is you have got to go cross-brand. You've got to go beyond the structure of the market as it's seen by these gatekeepers. And so what I started doing 6 years ago was looking at the idea of when I'm doing a new concept that I feel like has particular potential, that I do a screenplay and a novel together and try to sell this into the either film or television industry while I'm trying to sell the book. And I failed for 5 years, but this year now I have contracts both for a feature film with a company here in England and for a series of made-for-television movies. So it's been an investment, but I feel like that something like this, you have to break the boundaries, I think, in order to grow beyond the constant. If you are particularly lucky, or if you find something that has that an instantaneous impact within the market, like the Lee Child's books, for example, then you know these are the exceptions. But for the average journeyman author like me, how do you do it? And the answer is you've got to look beyond the standards, find something else.
That's good. Yeah, and I was just thinking, you know, when you're talking about breaking through and writing both screenplay and novel, what would you say is at the core of both of those for the stories that you tell? Is there an emotional resonance with the viewer, with the reader, at the very heart of those stories? Because you're translating it, really, from one media to another. How do you actually do that and keep that core of what makes that story shine or sparkle unique?
Well, for myself, and I think, you know, William Goldman takes a very different perspective on this. For myself, though, what I have found is that I'm telling two different stories. There is an emotional construct that there has to be something that maintains that sense of my loyalty as the artist to the potential audience, so that if there is a, God willing, a million-selling book from the project that is generating the film, the fans of one will find a resonance with the other. But unless you have a global hit at this, you know, monumental level in advance of the film project, so you know, you've got a Hunger Games, for example, where the studio must accept what the book has, because even if they have just the people that have bought the book attend the film, they have a success on a commercial level. What I'm trying to do at this stage is to grow both brands, grow both the film project and the book project. So what I'm looking for is some core element that makes the film project special enough that a person who doesn't have a number one bestseller in the New York Times to work from is still looking at this and saying, I can make money from it. And the answer is you have to go at this from the perspective that film and book are not the same. You have 96 minutes in a film to tell a story that in the book I took 400 pages and or 500 pages in the case of the fantasy. Mm-hmm. And the issue is, how do you winnow this down? How do you distill it down to an essence so that the fan of the book is going to read to watch the movie and say, oh yeah, that was really cool, instead of feeling like, I mean, the perfect example for me is a book that I thought was just phenomenal from the science fiction side is Jumper, that they redid with Samuel Jackson and a couple of other people whose name I can't remember, and it was just appallingly bad.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, there's a lot of answers. I'm not going to get into that. That's part of working in the film world. There is no one author in a film project.
Yeah. I think that's actually kind of cool. It's neat that you can go into a film project and you have all of these different voices that contribute to the overall film, and it really makes a film in many ways so much more layered. And I mean, with a novel, it obviously can be layered because you have words that you can put on the page, but film has to be, you know, all visual, but they have all so many layers in a film, and I think it's because it is more of a collaborative kind of thing. I mean, is that kind of what you've found as you've created?
Yeah, and it's really nice that you would say that. I mean, normally when I'm talking to people about this, both, you know, just talk and also on air, the normal thing I hear is that, oh, you know, I always prefer the book to the film. And I'm thinking, well, I've got, you know, several examples of films that I thought were fabulous that I thought the books were terrible. I mean, mm-hmm. Just to give you two examples, I thought John Grisham's first successful book, The Firm, was really badly written. I'm sorry, John, but mm-hmm. I really did think so. The movie was unbelievable. I mean, mm-hmm. What they did with that, it was just so beautifully put together. They winnowed it down to the, you know, the essence of it, and they reworked it and came up with this phenomenal film that launched a lot of careers. That's one. And the other is World War Z. I don't know if you've ever tried to read that book, but I found it, you know, it's like the first 50 pages. Oh, wow, this is really cool. And the rest of the book was like, it's so boring. It's just a repetitive sort of jumping around, all this stuff. It's just, and if I understand it correctly, Brad Pitt actually, when they were filming it, said, you know, guys, you know, it's not working and I'm not going to be a part of a failure. And so they redid it as a story. And again, I feel like the film is just so much better than the book. So these are the models that I use when I'm writing the screenplay. Even if I love my book, the question is, when I go back and do the screenplay, how can I make it a better story?
Right.
So, yeah.
Do you write the screenplay first and then the novel, or the novel first and then the screenplay?
In the film case, the one that I just finished writing the screenplay for, the novel was written first. And it's called Emissary. And when that was completed, then I did the screenplay. And I actually, the film production company is based here in England, and it's a really big group. And there was no way that they were going to even discuss with me the prospect of my doing the screenplay. So I ended up writing the first half of the screenplay for free, and begging them to read it. And they had not finished negotiations with the screenwriter that they wanted at the time, and they read it, and they said, okay, you know, you're it. So
you're it.
That's great. So with the film project, with the television film project, these are four made-for-television movies. In that case, I did the overviews for the films and then redid them according to what the producers wanted. And I had the concrete structure for the films. And then the books are going to be based upon the overviews, but there will be two different stories. There will be the television constructs and the book constructs. Very different.
Wow. That's very cool. So you did bring up Emissary, which makes me, I wanted just to ask you about this concept of expanding your boundaries a little bit and the idea of a pseudonym. So can we talk about that, that whole idea of, you know, you've chosen to write in a pseudonym. Could you tell us why you did that? And then, you know, if that's is that a good idea? Is that a bad idea? How are you feeling about that?
Sure.
So the pseudonym is Thomas.
I'm just trying to think where to start.
Yeah, right. Well, let me just throw it out there. The pseudonym is Thomas Locke. And if you're interested in finding his books, you can go to davisbunn.com, but you can also go to tlock.com, and that's Locke with an E. And he's got a whole another website. And so it's really interesting because you have this whole line of books written by this very cool Thomas Locke guy. You know, I'm just curious, you know, you've talked about like expanding our boundaries as writers. You know, you talked about screenplays and you've obviously co-authored, but now you've got this other pseudonym. So anyway, so that's kind of a little background for our listeners. So now go ahead and dive into that answer there.
Okay. We're going back again to the same period of that uncertainty. The market was going down. Our sales were going down. Jeanette had retired. I didn't know what to do. And again, I think one of the issues that that I was seeing at that point was a lot of the people that I started off with, whose work I admired and who I admired also as just, you know, really great people, were effectively, they were giving up. They were retiring or they were, you know, reducing themselves, all of this. And I just felt like, my gosh, you know, I just feel like I've finally gotten to the point where I can write the way I want to. The last thing I want to do is to slow down. So I was trying to do a screenplay. You know, I was going around basically offering my services for free to anyone who was willing to even talk to me. And that was how I got my start. And then
wow.
The other thing that I did was I started doing one book a year beyond the boundaries of anything that I'd ever tried before. And it all it took really was to start asking the question, what am I not doing? What have I haven't tried that's still a real passion for me? And my first passion as a reader back, you know, when I was a kid was science fiction and fantasy. And I've been increasingly not in opposition to the books. I mean, you know, I loved The Hunger Games. I thought World War Z as a film was phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
But what I dislike is this idea that everything in fantasy and science fiction has moved towards the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So what I wanted to do is to see if I couldn't write a book that went back to the classical structure. Now, we have to understand, you know, originally the reason why fantasy existed at all, or that they started writing it, obviously had been around as a legend structure for a long time before mankind started writing. But when the Greeks originally started doing this, actually the first book ever written down that has arrived to us in any sort of concrete form is an epic form, epic poem that is also in the form of a fantasy. It's called Gilgamesh. But when the Greeks started with this, the reason they did it was because they were trying to take the normal, average person and put them in an impossible situation and show that with right thinking and right action, the normal person, just the regular guy, can grow into a hero or fail, depending upon the choices that he or she makes. And I wanted to go back to that. It's what spurred Tolkien, C.S. Lewis used it, and I wanted to see if I could do that. So that was the first one that I wrote. That was called Emissary. And the other, I decided I'd do the same thing. Michael Crichton had died, and he had a major impact on me in terms of character structure, pacing, and the way that he, in very terse format, was able to combine deep three-dimensional characters, very solid dialogue with a extremely fast-paced story. So
mm-hmm.
I decided I'd do a near-time sci-fi on a Crichton-esque sort of structure, and that was Trial Run, which is the latest book that I've had released. It came out about 3 weeks ago.
Wow.
So I've had these two, and at the time, you know, I did the fantasy first, and then I wrote Trial Run, and I didn't have any way of getting them out, and I had my the closest friend that I have within the publishing house that I work with, who came down when I was in the middle of writing Trial Run, and I told him what I was doing, and he said, you know, they both sound really interesting, and he said, I'd love to read them, but there's no way we're going to publish them. So I sent them both when I finished, and he took them to the president of the company, who came back and said, we will give you contracts for both of these on two conditions. First of all, they have to come out under a pen name. And secondly, you can't stop doing the Davis Bunn books. And it was like, you know, to this point, I had been trying to find some outlet that would be willing to take more of my books because I was writing more than the buyers, the gatekeepers were willing to accept.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like, oh, gosh, wait. Let me think about that.
Yeah, let me think about
that. Yeah, right. That's rare, actually. That's fantastic.
Yeah, this is great. We're going to have to wrap up in just a second. I was just taking some notes, you know, as you were writing, and some of the thoughts that I had that I think can really apply to all writers is go cross-brand. You mentioned that. Break the boundaries. I think these are huge. Instead of being locked in with a certain brand or genre, break it out, branch out, pursue your passion, and tell heroic stories. I think these
and grow beyond your strengths.
What's that?
Grow beyond your strengths.
Oh, nice. Yes, and grow beyond your strengths. And these are all key, I think, to whatever the stories are we're telling, whether it's novels or screenplays or whatever. And it was fun. I was, like, listening. I'm, like, taking notes, like, oh, yeah, yeah, this is good. I can totally put that into practice
myself.
That's
so cool. I mean, to have an author that I admire start taking notes, it's like, okay, you can send me a check now. Or actually, no, I tell you what would be better is you can send me all of your books that you publish from now on, I get a free copy.
That, yeah.
great.
So, Davis, what's actually the best place for people to keep up to speed on your books or appearances online?
I think probably the davisbund.com will have the link to the Thomas Locke. But if there is indeed the success with the Thomas Locke, they're going to become increasingly divorced so that, I haven't even discussed this with the publisher, so if they're listening, I'm probably in trouble. What I would like is that by the end of next year, there's no longer any mention of Davis Bunn and Thomas Locke, that they're
so,
just completely separate.
So we are still in
both.
On the secret
yeah.
identity. So.
TLock.com for the science fiction and fantasy, and DavisBunn.com for everything else.
So both Davis and Thomas, we're honored that you took some time away to be with us from your writing schedule, which is super busy. I don't know how you do 4 books a year. So we're going to wrap up. So anyway, for info on my books, you can click to stephenjames.net.
And for my books and information about my story coaching, go to learnhowtowriteanovel.com or susanmaywarren.com.
And for more about our guests and to check out our other broadcasts, click to the Story Blender. And always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.